Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. Tonight is the full moon night, and the full moon of December is the time when we traditionally remember the enlightened nun, Sanghamitta Teri, who took the shoot of the Bodhi tree under which the Buddha was sitting when he became enlightened, from India to Sri Lanka. And also she took the higher ordination for women, the full ordination as nuns from India to Sri Lanka. And this is traditionally the time when I give a talk about nuns. And it just happens that tonight we're fortunate enough to be here on the full moon night itself. Recently at the 10-day retreat, someone asked the question, is it possible for women to become enlightened? And so it seems to me quite important that we restate the teaching of the Buddha that women are just as able as men to become fully enlightened, that we have the same potential for spiritual growth. But the other thing that we need to remember, and this is what Acchanchitamalo pointed out very wisely in the retreat, that if we're women or men, if we think of ourselves in those terms, then we can't become enlightened. Because the mind that is still thinking in terms of categories and still identifying with this body is not able to realize the unconditioned, is not able to see beyond the conditions of this life. And so when we talk about the capacity to become enlightened, we have to realize that we're not talking about it in terms of male and female, although those are the ways in which we describe aspects of our experience. And these are very fundamental, very powerful aspects, our gender. Our gender often determines our social status, and the opportunities for education, for example, the biological functioning of the body means that we have certain things happening throughout our life which are outside of our control. They happen because we have a body that's male or female. So these are conditions which need to be taken into account, but they're also conditions which don't directly affect whether or not we can become enlightened. I mentioned the enlightened nun Sanghamitta Teri, and she didn't live at the time of the Buddha. She lived several hundred years later. She was the daughter of Emperor Ashoka, who was a disciple of the Buddha, again not from the time of the Buddha but in the generations after, who became a devoted Buddhist, and as the emperor of India made Buddhism the religion of the court. And so royalty, even members of his own family, entered the monastic order, both monks and nuns, and practiced and became enlightened. And this point about royalty taking the step to leave behind their royal position and their royal luxury, their royal power to enter the Sangha is one of the interesting points to reflect on as we consider the history of the nun's order, for example. Sanghamitta Teri left behind her royal privilege and became fully enlightened. As the first nun, who was the Buddha's foster mother, Mahapachapati Gotami, she also left behind her royal status and her royal privileges and luxury to take up the homeless life. And as we contemplate this, it's interesting just to watch what the mind says about that. How could they take that leap of faith away from a life of comfort, something that was quite special when you consider the position of royalty, for example, with Emperor Ashoka, where he was an absolute ruler. And he had gained his throne by dispatching any of his relatives who were a threat to him. He was the most powerful ruler that India had ever known. And so here was his daughter willing to leave that behind and leave her family and enter the monastic life. Recently, you might be aware of a few royals who've done similar things. There was a princess in Japan recently who surrendered her royal title and all her royal privileges so that she could marry a commoner. And then we have our own Princess Mary, who has gone in the opposite direction, you might say, because she surrendered her citizenship and her freedom as an ordinary person to enter the royal household in another country. And from what I've read in the newspapers, I don't know whether it's accurate, it seemed to be that she not only relinquished her citizenship, but in the event of a divorce, she relinquished any right over the children of the marriage. Now, when we consider that, someone giving up everything for love, romantic love, very often we think, oh, that's wonderful, isn't it? Oh, it's just perfect. Think of that, achieving that. That perfect match, and being willing to give up everything so that one could enter into it completely. And all the benefits that come from it. And we have this idea, this romanticized idea of this happy union and how much security, how wonderful it will be to be in that kind of relationship and to feel it so deeply that one is willing to give up everything. But when we consider royalty like the Princess Sanghamitta giving up her royal household, giving up all of the privileges that go with it, all the comfort, and entering into the homeless life, seeking something that is intangible, then we might think, crazy, eh? What could there possibly be? I mean, so uncertain too. I mean, if you get married and you marry the prince, well, at least you're sure to get something substantial out of it, something material, something that you can show, assets to take away with you. But going out into the homeless life, taking up the spiritual path, how can you be sure that you're going to get something from it? Giving up everything and no guarantee that you're going to have anything to show for it. And so when we consider this, it's interesting to just reflect on the strength of faith there must have been to make that move just from home into homelessness. And then for Sanghamitta to make the move not only from home to homelessness, but from her country of origin, where her father was the in charge. If anything went wrong, she could always go home to daddy, to move from there to another country. Again, with no real guarantee that it was going to be a smooth path. Here she was taking the teachings of the Buddha. Here she was taking the lineage of ordination for women from India to Sri Lanka. And she did so out of faith. And so when we contemplate that, it brings for me a lot of inspiration, a lot of gratitude, a sense of awe, really, that someone could do that. And then also to realize that she was fully enlightened when she made the trip from India to Sri Lanka. So she already had the tangible rewards for the sacrifices that she'd been willing to make. And that she was able to take the lineage to Sri Lanka means that that lineage was able to move throughout the world, to go from Sri Lanka to China, from China to Korea, from Korea to Japan, to Taiwan, and to come back to the West in the modern days, in the modern era. When Sanghamitta made her trip and when she practiced, it was after the time of the Buddha. And so she's evidence also of the fact that even after the Buddha had passed into parinibbana, it was possible for practitioners to realize full enlightenment. And if we go back to the time when the Buddha was still alive, we see that there were many, many women who entered the homeless life, became nuns, and attained full enlightenment. And tonight I'd particularly like to mention a nun who ordained at the time of the Buddha, but you might say kicking and screaming all the way from home into the homeless life. Her name was Abhiri Rupa Nanda, and she was very beautiful. She came from the Sakya clan, the same clan as the Buddha, but not from his immediate family. She wasn't of royal blood, but she was from one of the very prominent families. And her family were very well off and influential, and she was very beautiful and obviously very cherished by her parents. And when she came of age, they gave her the gift, if you like, of choosing herself which of her many suitors she would like to marry. And this wasn't always the case if you know anything about the social conditions in the time of the Buddha, as also even in modern times in Indian culture, very often marriages are arranged and the people in the marriage don't choose their partner that is chosen for them by their parents or relatives. But she was given the opportunity to choose her husband from among her suitors. And so she did that. She chose a certain young man, and on the day that she chose him, he died. We don't know from what reason, but you might say that hers was the kiss of death. This poor fellow died after having been chosen as her husband. Now, we might say, well, there's no direct connection between that, but that wasn't the way that it was perceived by the people in her social situation. She was considered to be of very poor fortune, a very unfortunate young woman to have chosen her husband and for the husband to have died that very day. And so she wasn't given a second chance. Perhaps her parents thought that having had such an ill-fated experience, that she was never likely to find happiness in marriage. But whatever the reason, they refused to allow her to marry, and they forced her to become a nun. They forced her to get to a nunnery, as the old expression is, get thee to a nunnery. And that was where she had to go to find her place in the world. And she didn't like it. That wasn't what she'd chosen. She wanted to be married. She wanted to be living the life of a householder, and she wasn't given that opportunity. So she wasn't a happy little nun. She was rebellious and miserable. And one can imagine that she didn't enjoy participating in the lifestyle, and she really didn't have much interest in practicing the so-called spiritual life. But she was stuck with it, and so she had to make the best that she could. Being still very beautiful, she retained that sense of herself as still being precious because of her beauty. And you can imagine that amongst the other nuns, of course, coming from all different backgrounds with all different dispositions, she would have been someone that they recognized as, oh, that's the one whose husband died. That's why she's come in here. She couldn't even get married because her husband didn't even make it to the altar. She's not here because she wants to be here. And so she would have been described in that way by many of the people who didn't perhaps take kindly to the fact that she made it known that she was there under sufferance. She wasn't there and wasn't cooperative. And so that would have been something that they could have latched onto. Who does she think she is? She might be beautiful, but you know what happened to her husband? Didn't even make it to the marriage. And so this was her situation. Identifying with her beauty and mourning for what she'd lost, and being someone of note because of her unfortunate circumstances and her misery. Now, after some time in that state of mind, you can imagine that life was a very unhappy thing for her. And it said that although she was not a willing member of the Sangha, that she had developed in the past many spiritual qualities, and that she was in fact ripe for realizing the truth of the way things are. And the Buddha himself recognized her potential, and he knew what her disposition was, that she was still infatuated with her beauty, that she was clinging to her physical form as the last refuge of her sense of being something, being someone who was okay, someone who was all right, someone who wasn't a failure. And so the Buddha set up a lesson for her to help her to see that she was seeking refuge in a place that could not sustain any security for her. He sent a message to Mahapachapati Gotami, who was the head of the order, that he wanted to see all the bhikkhunis, all the nuns who were living in that area. They should come to receive direct instruction from the Buddha. And so the word went out that they should all come to receive direct instruction from the Buddha. But Nanda, knowing that she would stick out because she wasn't developed in her practice, she wasn't cultivating mindfulness, she wasn't at peace with herself, and realizing also that the Buddha would know very clearly what was going on with her, she tried to work out how she could refuse to go for the teaching. And she sent a message that she was unable to come. But the Buddha, already realizing what would be going on in her mind, sent a message together with his summons that no nun should send a proxy. Everyone had to attend. It didn't matter what state of mind they were in, they all had to front up. And so she did. And of course you can imagine how going along and being part of that group reluctantly, feeling at odds with the situation she was in, she was probably trying to not be conspicuous, just be in the background. But of course the Buddha wasn't put off by that. He could see what was going on with her. He knew what was in her heart. And it's said that while he was giving the teaching, he realized that she had the potential to understand the truth of life, even though her mind resisted the situation she was in. And so while he was giving the teaching, it said that he used his psychic powers. And using his psychic powers, he created the form of a beautiful young woman standing beside him. And whether only Nanda could see this beautiful woman, presume that's what the situation was, she could see this beautiful woman, young, fresh, just as she was, but even more beautiful than she was. And she became spellbound by the sight of this young woman who she didn't recognize, but she just saw how lovely she was. And using his psychic powers, the Buddha not only created the image of this beautiful young woman, but little by little, he allowed this image of the beautiful woman to age, gradually to show the signs of time passing. And as Nanda watched this image of this beautiful young woman, she gradually lost the freshness and started to mature and started to age and started to show the signs of age and started to look no longer so attractive, until the image aged to the point where it was bent over. Not only the face was no longer young, but the body was no longer young. The hair changed colour. The teeth changed colour. The teeth fell out. The hair fell out. The body stooped even further until the body collapsed completely. And while she was watching that image of this beautiful young woman changing before her very eyes, the realization came to her that this is the nature of this body. This is what happens even to the most beautiful form. This is what will happen to me. It's not happening right now, but this is what will happen to me. And she got such a shock from that realization that she opened her mind to the teaching. The place where she had been seeking refuge, her beauty, her fairness, was shown to be no refuge at all, no safe place. But how to move from her identification with her body as it was, still young, still beautiful, to seeing it as it really was, even while looking young and beautiful. And so the Buddha gave a teaching to her in which he encouraged her to look beyond the surface of the body, to look inside the body and see what was behind the skin, to realize that what was inside this skin was aspects of the body which we don't like to know about, which we prefer are hidden from sight. Aspects of the body, like all the parts that are bloody, all the parts that are slimy and slippery, all the parts that are really filled with waste products that we have to discharge from the body several times a day in order to be comfortable. And in this particular teaching, the Buddha encouraged Nanda to develop the mind in concentration so that she would be able and willing to look at what she didn't want to see, to look at those aspects of her own body that she really would prefer not to know about. This is something which is very relevant for us as we take up any kind of practice that encourages us to look at things in a new way. We can't look in a new way unless we prepare the mind first. If we look at this body with our old, normal way of seeing things, we see what we've always seen. And we very often are influenced by our emotions, by our moods, not able to separate ourselves, not able to see things from a distance, not able to see them with detachment. We see them in terms of like and dislike, in terms of aversion, yuck. Why do they always have to talk about the body like that? Why can't they appreciate how beautiful the body is? Why have we always got to talk about the things that are inside the body? Why can't we concentrate on how nice it looks? It does look nice sometimes. And we can feel the resistance to doing that, to looking at the body as it really is, until we develop the mind, until we prepare the mind. And so what the Buddha was saying in this teaching that he gave to Nanda was to take time, make the effort to develop the mind in meditation first, so that when you do turn your attention to examining this body, it isn't with aversion, it isn't with attachment. It's being able to look in a neutral way to see things as they really are. If we don't develop the mind first, if we don't prepare the mind in meditation, then all we see is what we always have seen. We only look through our conditioning. And we latch on to the things that we like or that we don't like, and we take them to be who we really are. So for Nanda, her physical form, her beauty, was what she latched onto. That was what she held onto, what she sought refuge in. For some people who have a negative bent, who are full of aversion, they latch on to an aspect of themselves, their appearance, their skills, what they can do, what they can't do, the moods that take over their mind. They latch onto those things as who they are. They identify, that's me. And so whether it's positive or negative, it's the same process of taking up something that is an aspect of who we are, an aspect of this body, an aspect of this mind, and relating to it as though it's the whole of who we are. Now, in the case of this body, it is a wonderful thing. It does have miraculous properties, but it's also unpredictable, unreliable, uncertain, and sure to go in the direction of decay and death. And so what we're not just looking at some qualities and not at others, but we are trying to discern those qualities which are the ones which can't be stopped. The ones which apply universally are not just to do with me and my height or me and my hair colour, but are to do with the nature of this body generally. And beyond that, what are to do with everything that comes into existence. So everything that comes into existence from the time that it arises is changing. Sometimes it's changing to growing and getting bigger, getting stronger. And then change goes in the direction of decline, getting weaker, getting smaller, getting drier, breaking up. Everything that comes into existence has this nature. And so that's what we're trying to discern with the developed mind, these universal qualities. And this is the universal quality that the Buddha was pointing out to Nanda. Now, the thing that happens in the course of our life when we are identifying with certain aspects of our physical form or of our mental qualities, our intelligence, for example, our dexterity, the skills we can perform with our hands, or when we identify with our status, our educational level, our sense of authority in whatever position we have in our job, for example, when we identify with those things as who we are, we're identifying with things that are constantly changing. And so they're not really safe places, not really refuges. But what we do when we identify with those things as who we are, we also identify other people as who they are according to those things. How someone looks, how good they are at that. And are they better than I am? Are they taller than me? Are they smarter than me? Are they older than me? They come from a different place than I do. They speak a different language than I do. They this or that, always comparing and judging. Always developing a sense of ourself in relation to others and developing a sense of others in relation to ourself. And this is what the Buddha called conceit. Developing this sense of self around things which are actually constantly in a state of flux and flow, constantly changing. We might say, well, our appearance, if I come from Sri Lanka, I always look like I come from Sri Lanka. If I come from England, I always look as though I come from England. But we know that these appearances are skin deep, literally skin deep. If you've ever seen anyone who's had plastic surgery, if you've ever seen anyone who's been in an accident, if you've ever seen anyone who's changed their appearance deliberately, it's skin deep. It's not that they can't be useful for us to differentiate between different people. In the world of conditions, we have to use certain things to say that one, not this one. But when we consider those things to be certain, lasting, definitive, stable, then we build up a sense of who we are and who others are that is not based in the truth. And not only do we have this idea, we have an idea of judging ourselves and others according to standards which aren't absolute, which aren't the truth. They are relative truth, but not absolute truth. And so in this particular teaching, the Buddha was saying to Nanda, all the things that you've latched onto as being who you are, this is what's causing you distress. So not only latching onto I am this body, but I am that person who didn't have a successful marriage. I am that person whose chosen partner died. I am that person. That is me forever and ever. That's how I am defined. That's the suffering, the Buddha said. Identifying with those things, hanging on to them, that's where the suffering lies. If you can see them as they really are, subject to change, conditioned, caused by certain influences, certain factors that arose, came together, produced this result, but not permanent, not definitive, not stable, then you can start to free yourself from suffering. Not only free yourself in terms of how you think about yourself, but how you think about others. Because we're always thinking about ourselves in relation to others. So we can ask ourselves, what qualities about me do I say are me? The things that won't change, that I don't want to change, that I like, that I want to hang on to. And don't we get into suffering when those things change, when we get older? When we look back and think, 50 years have already gone. Thinking about time passing and what we're losing as time passes, just in terms of this physical body. We're gaining things too in terms of experience, in terms of greater understanding, but sometimes we don't notice that because we're mourning the things that we've lost. Can we notice that? How hanging on to those things and identifying ourselves with them past their use-by date causes us suffering. This is what the Buddha encouraged Nanda to do, to contemplate on this. And she didn't become enlightened on the spot, even though she'd had a power teaching from the Buddha himself. She had to take that teaching away and use it again and again. She had to take the time, make the commitment to developing her mind in meditation, to getting to a point of stillness, quiet, getting to a point of inner peace and calm, so that she could put down her attachments, put down her identifications, and start to see things in a fresh way. And little by little, starting with the body, because she realized that was her strongest attachment. And it doesn't say how long it took her, but in the poems of the enlightened nuns, her poem is to repeat the teaching that she received from the Buddha. The teaching that once she was able to look beyond the attributes or qualities or conditions which she'd assumed to be her defining qualities, to look beyond those and to let them go, that she found true peace. In today's society, it's very easy to latch on to the appearance of things, to the appearance of people, and to make judgments about them, thinking that we can judge them on how they look, on how they dress, on how they speak, where they come from. Sometimes these are the factors which help us to get some idea about that person. But to assume that we know everything about them, we know what kind of person they are, because we can see those outer characteristics, is to miss the mark. We often prejudge according to our prejudices. We don't see beyond our prejudices to the person that we're dealing with. And just as we can do that to other people, so people can do that to us. This is the thing that we start to be aware of. Whatever ignorance we operate under, someone else will be operating under that back to us. And so, particularly in today's climate of suspicion and fear, it's very helpful to remind ourselves that we might have a superficial idea about someone or some situation from what we can see, what's obvious right now, but to think that we've got it all worked out and that we know the whole picture is to jump to conclusions. As much as we can see our own characteristics, our own qualities as being conditioned, the result of various causes and conditions, various influences, subject to change, able to be modified, that much we can start to see that in others. And as much as we can not identify with this moment, the emotion that's arising now, the thought that's coming now, the reaction I have now, as describing me totally, forever, that much we can look on others with the same understanding that all that arises, even within each one of us, our mind particularly, as well as our body, all this comes into being, stays for a while and passes away. And everything that arises is subject to change. So taking on the sense of a self, when we're trying to see through that, one of the things that we do is to look at what do I take to be me, what do I take to be a self. And this is how we practice to see the truth of this flux and flow. It doesn't mean that while we have this form, this mind and body, that we can give up those characteristics and conditions completely. While ever we're in this form, we're going to have a personality, we're going to have certain habits, we're going to have certain ways of doing things, but we understand that all of that is not absolute truth for ourselves and for others. So the teaching tonight is relevant for our situation in this day and age, but my purpose in using this teaching tonight was to reinforce the understanding that there were in the time of the Buddha many nuns and even women who weren't ordained at the time but who later ordained, who became fully enlightened, and that it's still possible for women who practice this path to reach full enlightenment. And as I said at the beginning, if we think of ourselves as our gender, then we still haven't gone beyond the conditioned realm, and that will be a barrier for enlightenment. So if we think of ourselves as man or woman, we're still short of the state of mind, the developed mind, that is necessary for the realization of the truth. So may this teaching be of benefit for all of you at this time, and may the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana.